The reading today is a Reader's Theater adaptation of the opening of Mary Zimmerman's version of the Odyssey. It depicts the muse visiting, and I will do the part of an actor, maybe even Homer himself, and Dottie will play the muse. The Odyssey. Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story of that man skilled in all ways of contending. Sing in me, muse, and through me. Sing in me, muse. Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story of that man skilled in ways of contending, the wanderer harried for years on end after he plundered the stronghold of that proud height of Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story of that man skilled in all ways of contending, the wanderer harried for years on end after he plundered the stronghold of the proud height of Troy. He saw the townlands and learned the minds of many different men and weathered many bitter days and nights in his deep heart at sea, while he fought only to save his life, to bring his shipmates home, but not by will nor valor could he save them. Of these adventures, muse, daughter of Zeus, tell us in our time, lift the great song again. A first story. Many years ago, I was working on a sermon late one Saturday night before we had the Saturday service, so I had the luxury or the curse of being able to work well into Saturday night on the sermons. Now, this particular sermon was about the mythological Jesus, and the main point of the sermon was that I really don't care if there's even a shred of historical truth in the story of Jesus. What I care about is that it's a good story and that it helps me know how to live my life. Well, here's the scene. It's 10 or 11 at night and I've got nothing. Just a few fragments, nothing holding it together. I'm working at the dining room table at our old house. There's no clock, but I feel like I can hear a clock ticking each second, getting me ever closer to reaching for that panic button. And suddenly, out of nowhere, an image pops into my head. It's an altar painting by Matthias Grunewald, one that I'd studied maybe a dozen years earlier and had only thought about maybe a time or two in those years. The altarpiece is named the Isenheim Altarpiece. Was created in the early 1500s. One of the panels is of the crucifixion, and it's the gruesome kind that I don't often really care much for. Jesus' fingers are distended, his limbs are twisted, his blood is oozing out of numerous wounds. And maybe most hideous of all, and a bit unusual, Jesus is covered with these festering lesions. Another panel on the altarpiece portrays an entirely different Jesus. Now Jesus is beautiful, fully healed, radiant, the risen Christ shooting up from the grave into the heavens. Gone are his lesions, gone is the pain. To be honest with you, when I first saw this piece, that panel struck me as a little bit hokey. But here's the interesting thing. Grunewald painted this altarpiece for a hospital chapel. And many of the patients in the hospital in his day suffered from a gruesome skin disease, which produced lesions just like those he painted onto Jesus. Imagine the power of this painting for those patients. Here's their Lord suffering as they were suffering. And here he is healed. The patients, I would guess, experienced Jesus not as some historical personage from 1,500 years earlier, far removed, but as a living presence in that place, in their time. Jesus was a presence that acknowledged the horrible nature of their disease and also offered a sense of hope. Hope, at least, that in some ways they were more than this illness. So this, I thought, sitting there in my dining room that night, this is the mythological, timeless Jesus. And with that image in mind, the sermon instantly gels, and I look around my dining room. Where did that come from? A second story, this one from Wellspring Wednesday, our Wednesday evening program just this past Wednesday. At one point in the evening, I invited the participants in the class to go out into the lobby where we had an art table set up, all sorts of art supplies, and I invited them to pick up some supplies and go to one of the other tables out there and create an image of the divine, something that made sense to them about the divine or maybe what their ultimate concern is. And I'll be honest with you, although I was not honest with them initially, I hate projects like that. Lots of voices whispering in my head, you're not creative. You don't have a creative bone in your body. Everybody's going to laugh at yours. You can't do this. I would call these voices the anti-muses. So I figured out, you know, I'm the leader of the class. I'll just make myself busy and I won't be able to do this assignment. But I could sense some resistance from some of the people at the assignment, and that was perfectly understandable since I felt the same. And the better angels of my nature said to me, you better do the assignment, buddy. So I took a deep breath and tried to open myself to the creative process. I decided to go up to that supply table without a preconceived notion of what I might create, to try to let the possibilities and the supplies speak to me, which is new territory for me. I grabbed some Play-Doh, some pipe cleaners, some of these shiny half marbles, and went back to my seat. And I thought there about what images of the divine speak to me. I thought of the columbine, the lone flower I saw on the Colorado mountainside that I shared about last week. And then I found my mind going to the images you can see in nature of a rocky outcropping and craggy, gnarled trees growing up seemingly out of the rock. I love seeing that little miracle in nature. It speaks to me of the divine. The divine, the spirit of life, is beautifully imperfect and tenacious and springs forth sometimes where we least expect it. The divine also is grounded in the earth, in this rocky soil. So the black Play-Doh became the earth, and the gold pipe cleaners, the trunk of a tree, and the green pipe cleaners, the leaves, and the shiny half marbles, rocks. And then I realized, yes, there's really stones up on the art table. So I took out the marbles and put in the stones, and I created something that I cannot pretend is a masterpiece, but it spoke to me. So I sat in the lobby looking at that. Where did that come from? I wondered. A third story. At some point in graduate school, I had to decide what I was going to be when I grew up. Going into grad school, I had narrowed it down to three main possibilities: teach world religions at the college level, or be a minister. So I picked a school where I could pursue both possibilities, but sooner or later, I would have to make a decision. For 2 years, I mulled over that question from every possible angle. It felt like such a large decision, so significant, that I just felt scared about making it, and I really did not even have a clue. The answer was a very long time in coming. And here's the interesting thing for me. I actually can't pin down a time when I decided. There was no definitive moment of decision. At some point, I just knew. The answer came up as if it was a fact in my soul. I'm going to be a minister. Looking back, I have to ask, where did that decision come from? And a fourth story. This one not my story, but the story of the people on Earth who saved the wounded Apollo 13 spacecraft after that explosion seemed to doom the ship. As the movie about the Apollo 13 depicted, after that explosion rocked the spacecraft, a bunch of NASA scientists and technicians sat down with all the contents that were aboard the ship. This is what they had to work with, things like duct tape and operating manuals. So while the crew struggled to keep the ship going, the ground crew sat around a table with all this stuff spread out, and they identified the critical needs the ship and the crew would have, and then they figured out how they could use those things on the table to meet those critical needs. They tried idea after idea after idea, went down many wrong avenues, but eventually they figured it out. Together, they figured it out. Where did they get that ingenuity? Where did it come from? Process theology asserts that we co-create the world with the divine. God is that force pulling us forward, encouraging us to be good and more whole people. God is love. But we make the decisions. We take actions. God does not do these things for us. God does not make us do these things. We do these things, perhaps influenced by God or not. We are, as the call to gather suggested, the playmates of God, and our playground is this world. So in the process view, every single thing we do helps create and shape the world. Each of our lives really is just one gigantic creative exercise. With each step forward, we create something. Sometimes it's beautiful, sometimes it's not. But each moment of life, each step forward, is a creative moment. This is what process theology means when it says we co-create the world. Well, an implication of this is that we then are all creative. If you're alive, you're creative. Even if you can't draw a stick figure or rhyme a line, even if you're tone deaf or dance like you have two left feet. Telling myself in that lobby that I wasn't creative on Wednesday night was a lie. We are all creative. Another implication of this belief in process theology is that creativity is not limited to the arts. All four stories I shared were about creative moments. My decision about what to do with my life was every bit as infused with creative opportunity as sitting out in the lobby with these art supplies facing me. Same with the Apollo 13 ground crew's efforts to save the ship. Life presents us with one creative opportunity after another. But what about the question that surfaced in all four stories? Where did that creativity come from? The ancient Greeks gave an answer. They said it comes from the muses, these goddesses that come up to you and whisper in your ear, or that are within you, whispering up from your soul. They are the source of creativity in Greek mythology. But did the ancient Greeks believe that creativity literally comes from these goddesses? I don't think so. At least that's not how I'd interpret it. The muse whispering in the ear or deep in the soul, I think, is a picture of what creativity looks like. It's an image, a metaphor. It portrays what it feels like when a creative idea seems to pop into your consciousness. So sitting there working on my sermon in my dining room that night, I don't feel like a muse literally tiptoed in the room and whispered, "Isenheim altarpiece," in my ear. But it felt like the idea popped into my conscience from somewhere outside of me or somewhere very, very deep down in. So picturing a muse whispering in my ear, that's a great image of what it felt like. So though I think the muse's explanation is not literally true, it does to me capture certain truths about the creative process. One significant truth for me is that creativity comes from somewhere beyond just me. There is some kind of alchemy of brain and experience and wisdom that adds up to more than me. Creativity touches on the realm of mystery I talked about in the first sermon. There is something, well, something divine about creativity. Not divine like some Orthodox God zapping the idea into you, but divine in the sense of being called forward in this next step to be creative in a good way. So the Greeks, to me, are on to something when they identified the muses as the source of creativity. There is something divine about the creative process. Another truth lifted up by picturing the muses as the source of creativity is that good and beautiful ideas seem to come to us sporadically and unpredictably. All artists, and we are all artists, have those lulls where nothing comes, and then those moments where the ideas seem to come forth fast and furiously. I struggled for days with that sermon on Jesus and got nowhere, and then suddenly an idea came and it all came together. A bursting forth of creativity. In a conversation with the youth group last week about creativity, one youth shared about his creative process in writing a paper. He said he was rereading the book that he was supposed to write about, and then, like the third time, one small sentence just unlocked the whole thing for him. Lulls and bursts. This seems to be the nature of the creative process. We have to wait sometimes for the muse to wake up and to whisper in our ear. I don't feel like there's anything I can do to compel the muse to wake up and appear. But I do think there are things I can do to invite the muse to visit. Some of the best things for me are slowing down, being quiet, and being out in nature. Every summer I go up north and do some work looking ahead to the year's sermons. And it's amazing how the creative ideas come up north, where the biggest decision I have to make every day is, like, where am I going to sit and where am I going to walk? The slowing down, the simplifying, consistently seems to invite the muse in. I think it creates in me a sense of openness and receptivity. And I often wonder up there, if maybe the muse is always visiting, but I'm too busy to notice. Another thing that helps me invite the muse in is to try to stop the self-judgments and the doubts. Those mantras that I reflexively started chanting in the lobby Wednesday night, "You can't do this, you're not creative," those put up walls against the muse. What works for me when those mantras start is to gently notice them, not to start bashing myself for having them, which only makes it worse, but to notice them without self-recrimination, and then to gently invite them, firmly invite them to leave. Of course, though, when it comes to what helps the muse visit, I think it works differently for different people. Some of the youth group members said they also like to get quiet and be alone. But another said that the muse only comes when he's busy, especially with his hands. And it made me think of Norm Thompson, a longtime member of the fellowship who died lately, In a service, we celebrated Norm as a brilliant scientist and also a very talented visual artist in retirement. And I have a sense that the creativity came from the same source. And part of what unlocked it for Norm was using his hands. As a scientist, faculty member, he would have endless meetings and endless dissertation defenses and so forth. And he loved to doodle during those. And the doodling kept his mind engaged and working, and also was the genesis of his art life in retirement. And then with art, he wasn't the kind of artist who could think his way to the solution. Instead, he would do the countless sketches, trial by error, tinkering, continual tinkering with his works of art. The hands were part of the process. I'm also struck that different things work for different people at different times. So for me, the up north solitude often invites the muse in, but sometimes that's not what I need. I need to be with people, to be talking. So, for example, like the NASA ground crew working on that problem, for me this week it was helpful to talk to the youth group, to talk at Fellowship Wednesday with people and a few people individually about creativity. I'm going to give the last word in the sermon to the Unitarian poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, a wonderful poem about the creative process. As the birds come in spring, we know not from where. As the stars come at evening from depths of the air. As the rain comes from the cloud and the brook from the ground, as suddenly low or loud out of silence a sound. As the grape comes to the vine, the fruit to the tree. As the wind comes to the pine and the tide to the sea. As come the white sails of ships o'er the ocean's verge, as comes the smile to the lips, the foam to the surge, so comes to the poet his songs, all hitherward blown from the misty land that belongs to the vast unknown. His and not his are the lays he sings, and their fame is his and not his, and the praise and the pride of a name. For voices pursue him by day and haunt him by night, and he listens and needs must obey when the angel says, write.